You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says the state DNR and Department of Justice should explain a major drop in fines for pollution.
First, we're checking in on the latest news at Lincoln Hill School for Boys. Over the last several months, new concerns about the youth prison have come to light, including news that an inmate was given the wrong medication twice and that school officials may have missed a red flag when it came to the hiring of their new superintendent.
Lincoln Hills and its sister institution, Copper Lake School for Girls, are both under federal investigation for allegations of prisoner abuse, child neglect, sexual assault, and other potential crimes. Federal agents are also investigating whether there was a pattern of civil rights violations against inmates.
Patrick Marley has been tracking the story, and he's with us now to share the latest. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Veronica.
Well, you reported on some new findings about a staff member at Lincoln Hills, its current superintendent, Wendy Peterson. And what did you find out about her past job performance before she came to Lincoln Hills?
So Wendy Peterson is the new head of the school, and prior to that, she was the deputy superintendent. Before that, she was effectively the principal or the head of the educational program at the school. Before that, for years, she worked at North Central Technical College, so I asked for her personnel file from there. And what I found out was that she had been demoted after her boss found that she did not have effective communication skills. So she was demoted. Her pay was cut by $14,000. She was told that if she didn't improve her ability to communicate with her superiors, she would face further job actions, potentially including termination. She quit about 2 weeks later and then went on to work for Lincoln Hills. Nothing we can see did Lincoln Hills ever do a reference check with North Central.
So you said she was given the opportunity at that job with North Central Technical College. She was given the opportunity to create a plan, improve. Is there any evidence that she did implement a plan and whether or not it was effective?
Yes, so she first got a letter in November of 2010 from her boss telling her there were these communication problems and they wanted to see from her a plan for improving. And she did create a spread. They gave her a deadline. She created a grid as to the different ways that she was going to effectively communicate and gave that to her boss. 6 months later, in May of 2011, she got a follow-up letter that said that plan had not been working. So I don't know if that means the underlying plan was a problem or that she just had not adhered to it, but that's when they said she was being demoted from an associate dean to a lower position and seeing her pay cut from about $74,000 to $60,000.
And you said that Wendy Peterson's new employers at Lincoln Hills, you couldn't find any evidence that they checked her references. Did you find any evidence that they had any sort of information about her past performance and maybe some of these red flags?
Well, I guess we don't know that. The Department of Corrections didn't answer the question as to whether they had done the normal reference check that you do of previous employers. The people who are Wendy Peterson's boss from North Central has moved on to a different job, and so I was talking to the human resources director at North Central Technical College. She said that as far as she knew, there had been no check from Lincoln Hills. The only other way that the Department of Corrections would have known about that is if they asked Wendy Peterson or she volunteered that information or, they learned it in some other way. But the Department of Corrections has never given me any indication that they were aware of her demotion and abrupt departure from the school.
And you talked about how she worked her way up from principal to deputy superintendent to superintendent, and you wrote and reported that there were staff concerns about her getting that superintendent position, that some staff actually tried to block it. What happened?
So she was a principal for a number of years and had some clashes with some staff. When she was up for the job of deputy superintendent, there was an effort to prevent that from happening, and there was a petition drive among the employees and they submitted to the secretary of the Department of Corrections at the time, Ed Wall, saying that they did not think she should be promoted into that deputy position. The department went ahead and gave her that job, and then she later became superintendent. That happened very quickly just recently when the Superintendent Wayne Olson, who had been put in just either late 2015 or early 2016, abruptly left his job, and then the new corrections secretary promoted Wendy Peterson into the job as of superintendent.
And what do we know about why she in particular was chosen for that job and what kind of maybe vetting process or interview process she went through at that point?
We don't really know a lot about why she was selected. You know, Lincoln Hills is at a pretty crucial moment. It's got this ongoing federal investigation. So I think they needed to find someone quickly. And, she is someone who has been at the school, familiar with the operations of the school, been in top-level positions for a number of years. They've had a lot of changeover at that school. And, you know, the last person they put in there was only stayed around for 3 months. So they might have been looking for some kind of stability, but that's a bit of speculation on my part because the department has not spelled out its rationale for why they saw her as the best person for this.
At this point, is the Department of Corrections standing by their decision to appoint her superintendent?
Yes. They said just before we published that story, when we asked some questions about it, that they see her as the best person to enact the reforms that they're trying to put in place up there as they try to make some significant changes at the school.
We're talking to the Journal Sentinel's Patrick Marley, and we're looking at the latest news from the troubled Lincoln Hills School for Boys in northern Wisconsin. And Patrick, I'm backing up a little. In April, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel covered stories about complaints that residents in Lincoln Hill were getting the wrong medication. What happened?
So we've found a case of a 15-year-old boy who's staying up there who was given some wrong medication in April, and he was. So he takes a medication daily. He was accidentally given his another inmate's medication and then immediately given his proper medication. He took this. His family was not informed, but his grandmother happened to visit the next day, said that she could tell something was wrong with him, asked him about it. He told her he had taken this wrong drug along with his regular drug. And the grandmother alerted the mother, who spent that weekend trying to get the attention of Lincoln Hills about this, and it's staffed differently. The management's not there on the weekends, and so she didn't hear from anyone, she says, until the following Monday. This happened on a Friday night, and so it was Wendy Peterson, who at the time was the deputy superintendent, called her, told her she would make sure that something like this never happened again. 2 weeks later, the exact same thing happened. A different staff member this time gave the boy again the wrong drug made the same mistake of the other employee. He took those drugs. They did not give him his usual drug that night. They did inform the mother of that. And so as you can imagine, the mother was quite upset by that. I wrote a story about that, and not too much longer after that, the boy in question that we've been writing about, his medication was wrongly given to his roommate. His roommate took that drug, and they had to get medical attention for him.
What's Lincoln Hill's response to this, and in particular their practice of letting guards administer medication instead of a nurse or other medical staff?
Right. So most Wisconsin prisons, it is the officers who give out medication. It's been that way for a long time. The only exception to that I know of is Tichita, which is the women's prison. There was a federal lawsuit there, and nurses dispense medication there. This has long been a concern for the officers who do this, saying that they don't have the training that they feel they need, to identify side effects and know about drug interactions. So they've been upset about it. Advocates for prisoners are upset about it. As you can imagine, it's much costlier to have nurses hand out this medication. The department did, after this most recent incident where I just described with a roommate of the boy we've been writing about got the wrong medication in his cottage. So Lincoln Hills is a campus with cottages scattered across it that the youth stay in. At that cottage, they are now having a nurse or nurses give out medication. They haven't made broader changes at Lincoln Hills. It's unclear how that's going to play out. But for the moment, for most, it remains the way it's been for years, where it's the officers giving it out. It does look like there may be a shift toward having nurses being more involved.
And just briefly, Patrick, the Department of Justice investigation is now at around 16 months. What can you tell us about how it's proceeding and what to expect?
Well, it's been a little quiet in terms of exactly what is happening at the moment. This thing's been out there for a long time, and in December, once it hit about the one-year mark, 50 agents and officers raided the facility. and did extensive interviews with staff and inmates. Since then, the investigation has been handed over entirely to the federal government, with the State Department of Justice only assisting. You know, when the state still had a role in it, the Attorney General said it could take another year. So that was maybe January that he said that. We haven't heard from the FBI exactly what their timeline is, so we don't know if that's been sped up some. But it is this dual investigation with the FBI looking at the criminal end of things and the U.S. Department of Justice looking at pattern and practice of civil rights violations. So I would expect that it's going to take a matter of months, but, you know, we'll see.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joined us to share the latest news from the troubled Lincoln Hill School for Boys in northern Wisconsin.
Coming up, it's Wisconsin Life. Then the director of a state wildlife group says the state may not be doing enough to enforce pollution laws. First, a look at the latest news with Peter Bryant.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at pollution in Wisconsin. Our guest is worried about a drop in enforcement of environmental laws.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. 3 years ago, Kelsey Reagan challenged herself to ride 500 miles from Davenport, Iowa, to Lake Superior. She made it and became intrigued by the idea of seeing how far she could ride if she just didn't stop. Reagan tells us about her path to becoming an ultra cyclist and her quest to set biking records in every state.
I used to be a runner, but I got injured doing that, and so I needed to find a different activity. I really didn't like biking at first. I thought it was all the mechanical things were confusing to me, and it wasn't as simple as running where you just put on your shoes and go. So I really didn't ride a lot. Until I found out about bike touring, where you just load a bunch of camping gear on your bike and start riding and go wherever you feel like going. So that's kind of what got me started into serious biking. I did my first bike tour in the spring of 2012 without any experience, really. Once I was trying to go across the Wisconsin River, and I was using Google Maps to get directions because you can choose the bike direction option and it'll give you roads that are safe for biking. And so I did that, and it told me that I could go across this bridge. And when I got to the bridge, it didn't exist. And the other bridges were quite a ways. I would have to go quite a ways out of my way to get to them. It was towards the end of the day, and I'd already biked like 70 miles and didn't want to add another 30 miles to the ride. I had a place lined up to stay on the other side of the Wisconsin River, so I happened to see these two old men who were fishing along the river, and I asked them, I said, "Hey, would you mind taking me and my bike to the other side?" And they were like, "Yeah, sure." I put my bike in there and hopped in, and they took me to the other side. I guess only in Wisconsin can you hitchhike with a bike on a boat. It's kind of addictive. I started on this bike tour. I started wondering how far I could go if I just didn't stop. And so ever since then, I've been trying to figure that out. I set this goal of setting a record biking across every state. A lot of those records haven't been set by women yet. So it's really exciting to be able to do something that hasn't been done before. I did Iowa last year and Wisconsin this year. So I started on the Illinois-Wisconsin state line. It's where Highway 14 crosses the border. There's a little town called Bigfoot, Illinois, and that's just east of Beloit. And then I ended at Wisconsin's northernmost town in Red Cliff, right on Lake Superior. It's north of Bayfield. It took 22 hours and 4 minutes, and it was 380 miles. And my plan for now is to do one state every year. So by the time I'm 73, I should have them all. I think I'll save the shorter states for last. I really like traveling, and I've always wanted to see all 50 states, so I figured that this would be a good way to do it. No better way to see a state than biking across it.
Kelsey Reagan is an ultra cycler based in Mineral Point. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. More info at wisconsinlife.org. There's been a major drop in fines for pollution in Wisconsin, according to information released by the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. According to the numbers leaked from a state source, fines for pollution dropped by about 80% last year to the lowest level in at least a decade.
Governor Walker and state officials have said the reduction in fines is part of an effort to work with potential polluters to fix problems before they require enforcement. But our next guest is worried that the Department of Justice and the DNR may not be doing enough to enforce state law.
George Meyer joins us now. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. He was the DNR secretary under Governor Tommy Thompson. George, welcome to the show.
Glad to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
So what kinds of violations would be included in these pollution fines we're talking about?
Well, these are all, and I want to emphasize, these are the major violations in these categories. Literally, there's probably thousands of more minor violations across the state every year, but about 60 cases out of thousands have been referred to the Department of Justice to get penalties and cleanup. But the kinds of things are animal waste coming off of farms in the streams, air pollution violations, hazardous waste violations, solid waste violations, and then violations from treatment plants at municipal and industrial sources make up most of them.
You've described this as a dramatic drop in enforcement. What do you worry about when you see numbers like this?
Well, there's two things that happen. And just so your listeners remember, we're not talking about minor things. These are major penalty cases that often by themselves would be $50,000, $60,000 type forfeitures or fines. And when you do not enforce on major violations after they occur, you need to have enforcement of those because it provides deterrence to others from being more lax or intentionally violating the law. The other reason why the danger in this is it's bad for business if, in fact, you don't keep a level playing field between the 99.5% of the businesses in the state that do a good job, and some do an excellent job in compliance with the law. And those bad actors that cut the corners, cut their cost, and then are able to outcompete with the good companies that are complying with all the state and federal regulations.
As we mentioned, the governor and other officials have said this is good news. Problems are being fixed before enforcement is needed. The DNR is working with a business to make sure they're in compliance before they get to the stage where they're being fined. Could that be the explanation for this drop in these major fines?
Well, it does not add up. As an example, just from last year, 2014 to 2015, those 2 years, which is last year's, we have records. The drop in the amount of fines was 80%. That didn't happen because of working with people over the last year or so. That is, it's incredible to believe that the efforts to work with businesses dropped serious violations by that much in the case of a year. And just so your readers know, you know, I was Secretary of DNR. I headed the Enforcement Division before then. Every state DNR secretary and their staff did the same thing. We always worked to try to reduce those violations and work with companies. But when you have a serious intentional violation or a very negligent violation, you have to assess a fine with it to prevent that type of behavior, besides getting cleanup and besides getting the company back, putting things into place to prevent pollution. Otherwise, you do not have an environmental enforcement system that will prevent increased pollution over the years. As an example, Wisconsin's waterways aren't getting cleaner anymore. they were up to a few years ago. What they aren't anymore. Many more streams are getting put on the federal list that don't meet water quality standards.
And what, George, as we start to wrap up, what would you want to hear from the state about this change in enforcement?
Well, the first thing is why it's happening. Aren't they doing the inspections? If they're not doing the inspections, obviously they're not finding as many violations. And after that, are they taking the worst of the worst violations and sending those cases to the Department of Justice? And from the Department of Justice, are they coming up with a sizable penalty that will be a deterrent to future violations?
We'll leave it there for now. George, thanks a lot for joining us today. That was George Meyer. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, talking about numbers his organization released showing a major drop in enforcement, serious enforcement of pollution violations here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, some people complain that young people aren't as engaged with politics as they used to be. But our next guest says that when you look at how young people have used the internet and new media, they're more civically engaged than you might think. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up after 7, it's fast-paced storytelling with Snap Judgment. This week, we'll hear stories of people with unbreakable wills. That's coming up tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, young people have long been criticized for not being civically engaged, maybe voting less, not knowing where countries the U.S. is at war with are on the map, more likely to watch satirical news programs than serious ones.
But what if political engagement hasn't declined? It's just changed. A new book called By Any Media Necessary is a collaboration between 5 experts who look at how new forms of communication are shaping political engagement. And that means looking at how young people with a political cause have used Facebook, Twitter, viral videos, memes, and pop culture to talk about issues that matter to them.
Joining us now is Sangeeta Srestova. She's one of the book's contributors and the director of the Henry Jenkins Media Activism and Participatory Politics Project at the University of Southern California. Sangeeta, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, a lot of times there is this kind of talk. What's wrong with kids today? They're not involved in politics. They're not trying to change the world. You clearly, in this book, don't buy that.
No, we don't. And in fact, some of the youth we talked to specifically spoke to that. When we interviewed them, they're like, people say we don't care, but we do. So we really see this book as giving voice to those people, to those young people. We specifically looked at communities of youth where youth were assuming leadership roles, they were forming movements, they were taking action on issues that they cared about, and looked at what was happening in those spaces.
And one thing you have looked at yourself is this idea that if someone is politically engaged in part online, via Twitter, or watching online videos, things like that, it's kind of looked down on as not serious activism. It's not seriously something that is political involvement, civic engagement. Can this be a healthy part of our political diet, online social media activism?
We believe it is. You're referring to the clicktivism critique.
Right, or slacktivism, called,
yeah,
people call it.
Slacktivism. Yeah.
Yeah,
there are several terms floating around that are all kind of dismissive of this. What we actually found was that young people are operating on a spectrum. So new media use is on the spectrum of everything they do. It's part of their lives, just like the telephone or accessing the radio has been for generations before. So it really makes sense that they would reach to new media when they want to mobilize around causes that they care for.
Is it often the case that that's the beginning and the end of it? They watch something online, they maybe comment online, they youth involved in politics, and that's it? Or do you see this as leading to something else or connected to other types of political engagement?
It can be connected. It can be the end of it for that particular moment. So it could be, let's say, a young person sees a video around environmental issues and just clicks and likes it, and that's it. But it might be that the next time they encounter that issue through their Twitter feed, they're just a little bit more alert to it and notice it more. So it can lead to a little bit more of a deeper engagement. It certainly leads to a higher awareness of an issue.
You know, whether we're talking about young people or anyone else in a culture, it seems like you're pointing toward a wider notion of what it means to be civically involved or politically active, something beyond writing a letter to the congressperson or voting on election day.
Yeah, we use the term participatory politics, which might not be the easiest term to decipher to refer to that. But what we really mean by that is a broader range of acts, a lot of them peer-to-peer, so not necessarily directed at an institution or a politician. So it could be sharing information about an issue you heard about, something that you just saw on Facebook. It could be having a dialogue about it with somebody you know. It could be you making a video about that issue or even connecting it to your favorite show and saying, look, this issue came up in my favorite show and I really care about it, and then circulating it through your network. So yeah, we're looking at politics that looks really different. The language of it is very different. It's often drawing on cultural practices. And also, it might not even be directed at political institutions.
In some cases, people don't even want to call it politics. They want to call it activism. Some people, some younger people you cite in the book, shy away from those labels.
Yeah, we jokingly said that politics has almost become this dirty word. It's this word that just nobody wants to be part of. I mean, I don't think that that's specific to youth. There's just this sense of disillusionment with how politics works and what it involves and what it means to be part of it. And a lot of the youth we talked to just did not want that label on them at all. Yeah, so activism was an alternative term, social justice, caring about things. There were a lot of terms that they were tossing around.
We're talking to Sangeeta Srestova. She is a contributor to the new book, By Any Media Necessary, The New Youth Activism. The kids are all right is kind of the message. They are involved in politics and civic engagement, not necessarily in a form that previous generations might think of or recognize. Now, you have written personally a lot about something that was all over the place 4 years ago, the Kony 2012 video. An organization produced this video, a series of videos actually, about a warlord basically in Africa. Can you remind us of that story?
Yeah, so the video, which became, I believe, one of the most watched or the most watched video on YouTube of its time, it spread in 48 hours and was watched over 100 million times. It was produced by an organization that was based in San Diego, Invisible Children. I actually had the opportunity to research them and spend time with them prior to the movie and saw them leading up to it as the final push to really accomplish their goals around getting Joseph Kony arrested. And I also had the opportunity to witness the aftermath of what happened, which was a very strong backlash, public backlash, then a nervous breakdown of the founder and an eventual effective dissipation of the organization.
And you look at it kind of on both sides. You think there are things this group, Invisible Children, did well and made a difference. And you and more so the backlash thought there were a lot of things that they'd oversold or been naive about or misrepresented. Can you talk about the pro and cons of this initially very successful social media effort that got 100 million views?
Yeah, Invisible Children, what drew us to them initially was that Invisible Children was incredibly effective at mobilizing young people in the U.S. So youth who, exactly as we talked about, might not effectively take action around issues, and they were very good about deepening their engagement around the issues, getting them to care. They partially did this because they were really good at telling the story of what is happening in Uganda and simplifying it so that young people would really get excited about it. For some of those young people, that then led to a deeper engagement. But for some, it just led to watching that movie and not maybe moving forward with it. And what happened with Kony 2012 was that this all blew up at that point. Suddenly, the fact that Invisible Children had this inside group that really knew all the ins and outs of the conflict wasn't enough, because hundreds of millions of people were watching, and they were judging based on that film itself. And that kind of led to the backlash, where suddenly people are like, who is this group, Invisible Children? And what have they been doing? Are they a scam? What have they been doing in Africa? Then there were voices from Africa, which were also critical of the organization, and it just spiraled.
A lot of organizations, nonprofits, political action groups, of course, are trying to use social media to advance their cause, their agenda. What kind of lessons do you think that we should be learning from Kony 2012 and that video and the backlash to it to make this more productive, maybe more transparent, more honest, and ultimately effective?
Well, the one lesson, which is kind of paradoxical, is there is such a thing as getting too many views, and that things can get too spreadable. Another thing to realize is that you really do not have control once the message is out there. It will get spun in different directions. It will reach audiences that you did not expect, and that's a good case scenario as well. So anticipating that, preparing for that, being ready for the critiques, having your website beefed up so that you can actually respond to those critiques, so that people who come looking for information can find it. Not having your website crash is also a good idea.
Switching gears a little bit, you also look at the role pop culture can play in activism, and there's a big movement apparently of people trying to create social change, help nonprofits and things like that, united by their love of Harry Potter. How does a pop culture affiliation like that lead to people taking this kind of public action?
This is, in fact, I would say, our core case study, because it really started a lot of the work that we ended up doing later. So the Harry Potter Alliance effectively takes the fight against good and evil, which is so central to the Harry Potter stories, to the real world. And so they think about Voldemort as climate change, for example, or they take stories around the enslavement of the house elves and reposition that to think about fair trade. And they take that all the way to thinking about fair trade chocolate that has Harry Potter's name on it. So this organization has been around for a decade now. They really helped move a lot of young people who cared about Harry Potter, but maybe would not have taken political action along the spectrum towards activism.
What's the forum on which they work together? How do they coordinate their efforts?
They're incredible. In fact, they're a great example of a networked organization. They are a 501c3, so they are an established organization. They have a legal entity, but they are decentralized. They work through local chapters. They spend a lot of time on Skype, on Google Docs. All the other work is happening basically through the networks and affordances of digital media.
We're talking to Sangeeta Srestova. She's one of the writers of the new book, By Any Media Necessary, The New Youth Activism, which looks at new forms of political engagement among younger people, everything from social media to pop culture to politics.
And we want to hear from you on this. How do you think political engagement has changed, if at all? What do you think of online campaigns like Kony 2012, which was circulated on the internet by both supporters and critics? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you think new forms of communication have changed activism for the better or for the worse? And maybe you're an organizer who uses these tools. Call us at 800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation after a look at the latest news with Peter Bryant.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Sangeeta Srestova. She's one of the writers of the book, By Any Media Necessary, which looks at how social media, viral videos, memes, and pop culture have opened up a new chapter of youth political life.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. What do you think about new forms of civic engagement used maybe more by younger people? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Are you an organizer yourself? Do you think you would have been able to bring attention to your cause without things like social media? Call us at 800-642-1234.
Sangeeta, one thing that you try to avoid in the book is using the youth as an overall universal description of all younger people. There's a chapter about libertarian youth and the way they practice activism online and elsewhere. And you focus on Muslim American youth and some of the unique challenges they face as a community that wants to get the word out about who they are and what they're like, and also is worried about too much scrutiny from the public and the government becoming maybe oppressive in their daily lives. Can you talk about that a little?
In fact, the American Muslim case study would be a prime case of a network that has a very loose affiliation. I did enter into the research through a specific organization, but I really spoke to a range of young people who maybe would not even consider themselves as part of a movement if we did not exist in a post 9/11 world in the United States. So it was really a situation in which I talked to young people who grew up in the decade after 9/11 and who realized that no matter what they did, they were going to have to represent Islam in America, and that their identity was de facto politicized, and that they needed to tackle that if they were going to figure out what their American Muslim identity looked like.
One thing you mentioned is that humor is one way that the people you talk to work to make these connections online. I want to play an example familiar maybe to public radio listeners, Maz Jobrani, often on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Let's give a listen.
Just once, I wish they would show us doing something good, man. Right? Just once, right? Yeah, man. Right? Show us doing something good, like, you know, like baking a cookie or something, right? Because I've been to Iran. We have cookies. Just once, I want CNN to be like, now we're going to go to Mohammed in Iran. They go to some guys like, hello, I'm Mohammed. And I'm just baking a cookie. I swear to God, no bombs, no flags, nothing. Back to you, Bob. The whole news piece. They're never going to do that. Even if they ever did that, they followed up with another news piece. They'd be like, this just in, a cookie bomb just exploded.
And Sangeeta, you say a lot of people who are not well-known comedians are doing the same thing online, trying to find humor in this difficult situation they face.
Yeah, Maz Jobrani is now part of an earlier generation of comedians who are out there really post 9/11 building community. So building community within the American Muslim space in sharing the experience and realizing that they all have a shared experience, but also communicating the condition that American Muslims are in to audiences outside of that community. What I saw in my research was that there were a lot of young people using humor, and sometimes it was very informal. It was my chapter actually opens with a Facebook post that was put out by Aman Ali in response to realizing that there was a lot of surveillance on mobile phones and realizing that maybe his phone was also being surveilled and really speaking to that. I also had people just making fun of it and saying things like, oh, this is for the FBI. You know, I'm just doing this so that you, just by the way, this was a joke just for the FBI. So what I found was that there were formal comedian spaces and comedians doing this, but that humor was really very much part and parcel of the movement and of the identity seeking.
We're talking about youth in the United States and civic and political engagement in new, often non-traditional forms. Our guest is Sangeeta Srestova. She is one of the contributors to the new book, By Any Media Necessary. We'll go to our callers at 800-642-1234 with Maureen in Woodstock, Illinois. Maureen, hi.
Hi. I was a lobbyist against the MX missile system back in 1980 on Capitol Hill, and I found that the representatives weighed the mailbags. One letter was worth so much because the person stopped to write the letter. And it was different from point and click that we do now.
Maureen, thanks a lot for that call. Do you think there's something there, Sangeeta, where if you are the politician or the politician's staff member, you might look at that email or that social media post and not take it seriously? You might still look at that old-fashioned signed letter and put a little more weight behind that.
I'm not in the position of the person on the Hill to really answer that question, but I would say from what we've seen as of evidence, we actually see social media being incredibly effective in getting, for example, corporations to respond to criticisms. I can speak from experience of having written many letters to customer service and maybe hearing back, maybe not, but I've also seen examples of people getting on Twitter and saying, you know what, you really treated me badly, and having a response within hours because people get behind it. So I feel like it can probably cut both ways.
Maureen, thanks a lot for the call. And I see at various points in the book a conflict kind of between older school people who are politically involved, whether it was activists or of the 60s and 70s, and then looking at the later generation of activists, maybe the current generation, and looking down at the way it's being done and not seeing as serious enough, maybe being seen as frivolous. Is there really that conflict, or is there more of a bridge between those generations than I'm making it out?
I feel as we move along in time, there's more of a bridge. But we did see a repeated reference to, well, you don't risk that much when you're online. It's very low-risk activism. I actually put my body into the front lines when I was protesting in person. And there's certainly something to that. With that said, though, we have seen people take incredible risk by posting something online where it could, in the case of undocumented youth, coming out online as undocumented could literally lead to deportation. In other cases, you know, in other parts of the world, this could actually lead to you being hunted down and killed. So it's not true that it's necessarily a low-risk activity.
And there's also, it's not like people have to do one or the other. We've seen cases of real-life, in-person protests having an online auxiliary or a coordinating effort via social media. So people are merging those in some cases, too.
I'm really glad you brought that up. It goes back to our title, By Any Media Necessary. So we really don't see it as an and or. In fact, the young people we spoke to very often referred to drawing on much more traditional mechanisms and tactics to achieve their goals. And in fact, they saw new media as just one piece of that equation and one option they had. So I really want to stress the agency side. So it's a choice. People are using media to achieve goals. If that media didn't make sense, they wouldn't use it just because it's digital. I think, because then it would really help them get to the ends they're trying to get to.
And very briefly, Sangeeta, do you think that this is only going to get more prevalent as more and more so-called digital natives enter into their civic and political lives?
I would say yes, because I mean, for example, betraying my age, I think of radio, television, phone as just very much part of, I pick up the phone to call somebody, right? So I might as well tweet at them and I might as well Facebook them in very much the same way. So it's just the difference of the medium, but maybe the practices say quite similar.
Sangeeta, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Sangeeta Srestova. She's director of the Henry Jenkins Media Activism Participatory Politics Project at the University of Southern California. She's a contributor to the new book we've been talking about. It's called By Any Media Necessary, The New Youth Activism. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.